Welcome to the latest installment in our series from Limerick to Lusaka.
I find it difficult maybe at times, yes, but the way I feel is we all find difficulties no matter where we are.
We have huge wealth. We have a wealth of people, wonderful people, and increasing in number, and great people, but we are poor.
In previous weeks, we have touched on the role of Irish missionaries in the development of the sub-Saharan country. This week, that is what our focus is specifically on. We will meet with two missionaries, one based in Lusaka and the other in Choma, and find out a little bit about the work they do. First, Nuala O'Brien of Irish Aid explains the significance of the Irish missionaries.
I think it's in education and in health. The missionaries have been working in all areas in Zambia, all regions, I mean, scattered throughout, particularly providing schools, primary schools and secondary schools, and running clinics and hospitals. And I think the evidence is in the high levels of education that people of the people who went through those schools and the good health care that was provided in the clinics and the hospitals.
I just came for a few months as a relief teacher to let somebody home on holidays. I came then to a school, a boarding school out in the bush, a place called Chivuna. It's near Monze and it's very rural.
Sister Virginia Milan is now in the town of Choma in the southern province of the country. Originally from County Wexford, Sister Virginia first came to Zambia in 1972.
And at that stage, we, the Sisters Sacred Heart of Mary, we were involved in really running the school. And there were, at that stage, there were no Zambian teachers. It was all expatriate teachers. Then I went back to Ireland again. I was teaching in Ireland in Ferrybank and Waterford. And then I came back again in 1979. This time I was appointed as a teacher in Chivuna. And this time, to my surprise, I suppose, at one level, I found that the whole system had changed, that the head was a Zambian, and that there was a good, maybe 60% of teachers Zambian at that stage. So in a matter of 7 years, there was quite a lot of change. And I think our sisters had been very instrumental in that they had really worked very hard to help to have a Zambian in charge of the school. We worked with them and we were the agents, so to say, for the school, but he was the headmaster. So that was a very big, significant kind of breakthrough in Zambia in 1979. So I worked in that school for 15 years. And I, of course, I had breaks. I went home to Ireland and had my holidays and so on. So I worked there in that boarding school for 15 years, and there were about 600 boarders. I suppose I really enjoy now meeting a lot of my ex-students and some of them in, you know, good jobs and good places and so on. And then in 1994, I was asked to be the inter-Africa coordinator for our sisters. And so I couldn't continue in a full-time teaching job. So I was transferred to Choma, our house here in Choma. And what I did then was I worked with children who couldn't make it to school, particularly girls who had maybe gone as far as grade 9 and failed and couldn't continue, or grade 7. I worked with them, and that again was a kind of a different phase, and it taught me a lot about life and the problems all these young women had to face. And at the other end of the scale, I had to move quite a bit to, say, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Mali and West Africa to work with our own sisters in those places. And that gave me a very broad vision, I think, of life in the African continent and different cultures and so on. And I think I got a very good understanding of Africa and a lot that Africa has to offer. That brought me up to 1996-97. Then I spent some time in administration for our sisters in the region of Zambia and Zimbabwe, and I didn't have any real contact with teaching or anything like that. I did a good deal of retreat work, yes, and mostly with lay groups in different parishes in Lusaka. And that, again, was a wonderful experience for me because I got to know a lot of people. I had a very, deep insight into their lives and, I suppose you could say, the vulnerability of life for so many. And I did that in my spare time, so to say. I didn't have a lot of spare time. Then when I finished in that job, we just have 6 years. You don't usually have any longer in a job of administration in our congregation. And then I spent some time on a sabbatical and I went to Brazil. And I worked there with vulnerable children, again in a sort of teaching capacity, small ones from, you know, two years, maybe to 6 or 7. And then in the afternoons I worked with bigger children. And they were all children who were very vulnerable and many of them were suffering from HIV. So I found that a very touching kind of experience. So then I came back to Zambia after that and I began to ask myself, what did I really want to do? And so I decided that I would work maybe in a hospice here in Choma, which had been begun by one of our own sisters. And I worked very much at the spiritual side, walked with a lot of people in terms of helping them to maybe journey, some of them maybe journey, they knew they were dying, and to walk with them. Others journeyed with them at various levels and they were restored to health, and I find that a great, you know, moment of sort of walking with people to be when they are restored back to health. Many of them would have had HIV, many of them were very responsive to drugs and what we call antiretroviral drugs, and were able to start a new life. Some maybe it was too late for them. They were maybe in the later stages and it was too late. So the most you can do really with those is to walk with them, help them to see where they're going, how things are, how they're feeling, and, you know, how they sort of see maybe what's happening to them, and to be very close to them and be with them. And many times, I suppose, I walked with people and I felt very sad when they departed, and I have many memories of those people and their great spirit, and I suppose it helped me also to see that so many young people between 18 and say 30 or 35, how they faced death and the courage they had in that. And certainly if I were a person who didn't believe in God, if I were like that, I certainly would have got faith and courage and belief in God from, I think, 98% of those people. They really helped me in so many ways. So sometimes the little help we can give is little because there is a great reciprocity. And I think I grew certainly in my faith. I grew in appreciation of, you know, what God had done for me and what he had done for others. And I found that a very kind of touching, I still do find it a very touching experience.
Professor Michael J. Kelly has been in Zambia since before it was even called Zambia. Today he's still resident in Lusaka.
I went from Tullamore to the Jesuits, although with the Jesuit training at that time we did 3 years of philosophy in Rahan. And it was from Rahan I came here. Our normal training program as Jesuits was that after about 8 years, 8 or 9 years of studies and spiritual formation, we were sent out to get our feet back down on the ground. And normally we would go either to one of our teaching colleges in Ireland, Clongowes or Belvedere, Limerick was there, Galway was there at that time. Well, Galway's still there. Or we would come out to our missions abroad, and we had missions in Hong Kong, we had people going to Japan, and we had people coming to Zambia. So here in Zambia, it was Northern Rhodesia at that time, We had a fairly new secondary school, it was only 5 or 6 years old, and they were looking for a mathematics teacher, and mathematics was my area, so I asked, could I be sent here, and I was. I had a brother, a Jesuit also, who was out here before me, and I suppose that gave me a certain knowledge about the country and a familiarity with it. And even my mother and father, who were Tullamore people, they said, well, she had not gone far, we know the place. And it certainly made it easier and made it more attractive. But yes, I think nearly all of us at that time in the mid-50s, we wanted to move, and we would have been happier, most of us at any rate, working in a mission country than working in one of our schools in Ireland. It was a very, very different country than to what it is now. First of all, in terms of population, I suppose there was about 2.5 to 3 million people in the whole country. Currently, there's over 12.5 million. So that's been one enormous thing that I feel very much noticed, because services for the people, shopping outlets, electricity, water supplies and all these haven't been developed at the same rate as which the population has grown. Schools also, medical facilities, hospitals. That was one thing. Secondly, roads were not very well developed. Nearly all of the roads were just dirt, dust roads. A situation I suppose we could sympathise with as Irish people very much. It was a colony, and the people were, at that time, mid-50s, beginning to feel that they had to get away from colonial rule. India had done so in 1947, and the African countries were watching when they could follow suit. And so there was a good deal of that anti-colonialism in the air in the country. I don't think we contributed very much to it, but I think we were very sympathetic to it all the time. When I came here, this wasn't just Northern Rhodesia or Zambia as it became. It was part of what was called the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland, a political settlement imposed upon these three countries by Britain, largely in collaboration with the white majority, and it was abominated by the African people. And we were working in almost entirely with the African people, and we shared their misgivings about it. The fear was that we would be, the Federation would be sucked somehow into the orbit of South Africa, which was moving very strongly in the apartheid direction at that time. Most of the education system in the country had been put in place by the missionary personnel, the primary schools being developed from the about 1915 onwards, and formalising of a lot of that in 1927 under a Department of Education which was established then. There was a very, very small education system. The British approach to the development of education was very different in Eastern Africa from the French approach in West Africa. The British approach was that you should broaden the base and get every child into school. And so there was a lot of emphasis on the development of primary education, but very, very little on the development of secondary and nothing on the development of tertiary education. So when I arrived in 1955, there were very, very few secondary schools in the whole country other than the mission schools. There were a couple of government schools now, and a government secondary school for boys was the first secondary establishment within the country. It was opened in 1938, I think it was. But coming in 55, 1938 wasn't so very far back. When we tried to establish the school that I went to in 1947-48, the priests had a lot of correspondence with the colonial Department of Education about the establishment of it, and they finally got a letter from its most senior official. We already have a secondary school for boys in the country. Why do we need a second one? That was 1948. India had become independent. It was obvious that this country was going to follow suit. and they were doing nothing, no thinking whatsoever about preparing people for it. The result was when Zambia, Northern Rhodesia, became the independent country Zambia in October 1964, there were 106 known university graduates in the entire country, and of those 106, about 56 were living outside the country because they had been supported by the Nationalist Party, and most of them were in Eastern European countries. There were fewer than 1,000 people in the entire country who had completed 12 years of secondary schooling. Now we had to start and run a country with that.
Sister Virginia has had quite a few links with Mary Immaculate College, primarily due to her involvement in various educational and community activities.
I am an educationalist by profession, I suppose, and once a teacher, you're a teacher forever. So I'm interested also in areas of education, and I work maybe just at a more helping level. In our school, we have a school for children with disabilities. I try to facilitate, and I work a bit with them. And then there are other areas in Choma, in the educational side, that, and some of your colleagues from the Mary Immaculate Training School, Training College, they have been here with Mr. Paddy Fulham, and they will know some of the schools that we have tried, such as Galundaga Maria, that we have tried to upbuild. It's a school for very, very vulnerable children, and it's a non-fee-paying school. Most of the other schools, they have to pay maybe a little, very little, but a little, and some of these kids can't afford anything. So that school is for them. There's another school in process of becoming called Arise, and that I'm interested in working with a bit with the Ministry of Education and getting their help and their advice in trying to get funding and so on for that school. And I think you saw for yourself that some of the contributions that came from some of the ex-students of Mary Immaculate Training Centre who had been here and came back last July, that that funding has already been used in starting the school. So I think you saw for yourself that school, it is arising. So hopefully by the time you come again, it will have risen.
For both Professor Kelly and Sister Virginia, education has played a major part in their lives in Zambia.
When a nationalist government took over in January 64 and then became independent in October 64, the first move in all the plans was rapid expansion of development of secondary education. And that was done at very great cost in the country, but also rapid expansion of other levels, and the university, which is across the road here, that was formally established in November 65, and its first teaching, quite remarkably, was on the Feast of St. Patrick's Day in 1966. The first students actually began their classes on that day. I was head of a secondary school in the south of the country at that time, and continued as head there until 70 or 71. Then I went to do a PhD, and I came back from the PhD into the university in 75.
What was your area?
I was in education. Education psychology, child psychology, and mathematics education. But as happens very often, you go into many other different areas. Later in the university, I went through a process of, I was dean of a school of education, and I was the deputy vice chancellor at the university. But then later, when I went back into the teaching and research area, I went into the area of education and development. And it was in that area that I was in up to the end of my time at the university, which was educational planning, educational management, education administration, the interaction between education and development. And it was working in that area that made me very much aware of the AIDS crisis when it broke in Zambia and when it really came to the fore. The first AIDS case was identified here in Zambia I think it was 1983 or 84. AIDS universally, internationally, was recognized in 1981. And it was about 2 years later, I think, it was identified here in Zambia. By the end of the 1980s, I was aware that in the education system, education and development had a lot to do with expanding an education system, and I could see that the expansion was going to be difficult if there was this threat of people dying, teachers dying, AIDS in families so they wouldn't be able to send their children, and also if people were dying, that there was going to be a problem of orphans, a major problem of orphans. So all of those things were very prominent in my mind, and I brought them as much as I could into my lectures, and then eventually we began to establish that this was a required part of all preparation. I was dealing with students who were coming in preparing to be teachers, who would be secondary teachers or who would be in the education field in some way. And so we felt that it was important that all of these become aware of the challenges that this new disease was posing for the education sector within the country.
Professor Kelly has become renowned not just in Zambia but worldwide for his research into HIV and AIDS.
I tell you one thing, there was an enormous help here. I think it was in November, December 1987 that a son of President Kaunda died. He died in Canada. And not very long afterwards, some months afterwards, President Kaunda announced publicly that his son had died of AIDS. And that helped anybody who wanted to speak about it publicly to do so. Mm-hmm. And so I found it was quite easy. Quite easy in the sense that there was nobody opposing, no opposition. But I used to be fairly blunt with my students. We had the figures, 20% of people infected, which meant one in every five, and people meant anybody, those between the ages of 15 and 49, the productive age group, but also the reproductive age group. So since I was dealing with university students, all in their early 20s at the majority, I had no hesitation about saying to them, right, here you are, 200 of you in this group, because it was mass lecturing. I'd say about 40 to 50 of you are infected with this disease. You don't know it, I don't know who you are, but you are infected. Mm. And they would laugh, a bit nervously,
yeah.
But they would take it. They took it very well. We related very well, so it wasn't a problem in that sense. And they enjoyed those lectures. When I say enjoyed, I mean they used to come to them. But what was encouraging was that students from other parts of the university used snuck in, as they say. And they use that term here. And attend the lectures also. There was room in the lecture hall, they would stand at the doors just to get the information, which was encouraging. It was absolutely out of control. All the programs to deal with it were dealing with it as firefighting exercises at the very, very last minute. The analogy I use is that they were getting people to strap on their safety belts because a crash was imminent. And that's too late. You should be teaching the person how to drive better and have a motor car that had the brakes were working and all the rest of it. And they weren't doing that sort of a thing. And they're still not doing it. They're dealing with it still as a last minute emergency issue, and therefore you've got to deal with it with people changing their behaviours instead of getting much further back to deal with the norms and the values and the attitudes that form people so that they behave in certain ways, and we're not doing that yet. Then there was considerable ignoring of the fact that nutritional deficiencies have a lot to do with, not with the disease in itself, but nutritional deficiencies expose you will more readily catch any disease, including this one. And nutritional deficiencies also made people a stronger transmitter of the disease. These things were not taken into, and they're still not taken into account.
While in Choma with Sister Virginia, she brought me to the local branch of Carrick Counselling, where I met with Vincent. Believe it or not, another father, Michael Kelly, also from Ireland, founded Carrick Counselling. I found out a little bit more about the work of this organisation, set up by an Irish missionary.
Carrick Counselling is an organisation of which Carrick Counselling Choma branch is one of the branches. We have 9 branches. But Carrick Counselling as an organisation was founded in 1989 by Father Michael Kelly, and then it was made into a registered trust, I think it was 1991. And from then on, it started operating from Lusaka. But from when there was a community need, and there was a request made to Carrick Counselling, I think through the church, that was there was a bishop for the of Monze Diocese, that this service be provided in Southern Province. Choma was chosen to be the place to set up one of the branches for Kara because it is centrally in the Southern Province. When you look at the distance between Lusaka and Livingstone, hence this was set up. But at the time that they were setting it up, there was Sister Philippa. By then, she was working with St. Mulumba, a school for the handicapped. So since she'd set up that school quite well, she was chosen to open this program, and then she set it up. At the time that was opened in 1997, the primary focus was HIV/AIDS education. And this was done within and the area surrounding Choma, both the urban and the peri-urban areas. And when that was done, people got to get some form of awareness. There was a need that was realized that people would like to learn their status so that each and everyone would take control of their lives. Therefore, a VCT department was set up right here at Kara House. This started operating, but it was noted that there was a need for more people to take up counselling skills and be able to provide counselling and testing in various settings, including in health centres. Therefore, the first course was run, I think, around about 1998, and this was for health workers, government employees. And after this was run, the training department was then formed, and it started introducing different courses, focusing on the needs that were appearing within the community. So one of the courses that was introduced was community home-based care, which was targeting community members who would want or who had the desire to help the people that had become ill or sick chronically due to HIV/AIDS-related symptoms and complaints. And hence, an extra wing was developed within Kara Choma, and that was now the community home-based care program. And this was mainly comprising volunteers, trained people who were volunteering to work with Kara Counselling in the communities. And that has been running since. Even the home base, the training department has been operating since to date. Even the voluntary counselling and testing services have been from that time to date. As I mentioned before, Sister Philippa was the founder, and she was manager of Kara Choma from 1997 till 2003. At the time that she left the program and left the country, then was called reassigned.
What is the church's relation to HIV prevention, and particularly in the relationship to the condom, the use of the condom? On that particular issue, certainly I've come across misunderstandings and limitations in the way people understand things. And I think there still is a little bit of a fear in church circles that if they ask me to speak, that I'll talk to them about the condom. As if that, because even though that is a way of preventing the transmission of the disease, it's not the answer. Mm-hmm. And I'm very glad to notice that the international agencies are now saying that it's part of the answer, but it's not the full answer. Up to about 4 or 5 years ago, they were saying this is the answer. And it's an area where I feel sad about it is to see in so many reports from all parts of the world so much emphasis on this. As one author, an American professor, put it in one of her books, said, I think it was Thailand, she said, knee deep in condoms, but as much HIV as there ever was there in certain pockets in certain areas, that relying on this to stop this epidemic is not going to work. And the United Nations program, which deals with this, as far back as 1999, it brought out a very fine report, again with an American university, and in that report, it criticized the ultra-rational way in which we as Westerns are dealing with this. I applied the words to it, what George Bernard Shaw back 70 years ago, said that planners think they can solve problems by brute sanity. And we're applying brute sanity to this. This is the thing, if you do this, you won't get it, therefore you will do it. And we believe that that was going to work. We know now, 30 years later, that that doesn't work. We're human, we're not absolutely rational creatures. I finished in the university at the end of 2001 or 2002, I forget now which, but the reason I finished the university, I could have stayed on there, was that I was travelling a lot, talking a lot at conferences, initially on AIDS and education, but it spread out a good deal to other areas like feminization, women and the problem, children and AIDS, or food security and AIDS, stigma and AIDS, a whole lot of these areas which are related with education, but they're not entirely with education, and higher education and AIDS. So these areas, I was being asked more to speak about them in various parts of the world, and that wasn't very fair to my students at the university. In order to fit in my program, I had to have lectures at 6 a.m. Now, the students actually liked that, because that left them free for the rest of the day, and it suited them, and they all turned up, even ones who didn't belong in my course. But I wasn't there if they wanted to consult me or ask me about things. And then it wasn't fair to my colleagues and the staff. They had to cover, and it meant correcting of assignments, and that was done very hurriedly, or I had to get somebody else to do that, and all of that wasn't fair to them. And also, I don't think it was fair to me either, to sort of give a couple of lectures here and then rush off to an airplane and come back and next morning have to be in there at 6 a.m, that kind of a thing. So in fairness to them and in fairness to myself, I thought the best thing was I'd stop the work at the university, but I'd keep this work going. And since I formally retired from the university, I've been more busy than I ever have been in my whole life. But I suppose I'm getting slower also, so the business is less has been done.
I have found tremendous progress at many, many levels. And I think that's fair to say. And I think if you look at a city like Lusaka, or even our own town here in Choma, that you can see there is quite a lot of prosperity. But side by side with it, there's also a lot of poverty. I think a lot of effort is on the part of our government. A lot of effort is being put into upbuilding. And I see upbuilding, because I've been here 29 years, I see it's a process. It doesn't happen overnight. And I think anything that happens overnight doesn't last either. But I think it is a process. And I think people who have maybe a bit of money now will become aware, yes, that they have the money. And hopefully they'll also reach out to upbuild other people. And I think that is happening. You know, it's gradual, but I think it is happening. There's a lot of awareness and a lot of conscientisation. The part that's sad for me really is that we have lost so many people through HIV and AIDS. A lot of what we might call active, educated people have been lost. But I do see, especially since I became involved, not because of me, but I just became more conscious since 2002, 2003, that a lot has been done and there is a lot of conscientisation, and people are coming now much more readily at the beginning stages. And if people come at the beginning stages, a lot can be done. They really can be saved for the most part. And with the advice that they get through counselling and the testing and all the medical advice that they can get at that stage, then they can live a reasonably good, healthy, positive life. And that, I think, is great. And I must say that, like, I just find great joy when I see people on the street that have gone through the process and they're back and they're working away normally, and they know how to live their lives, and they know how to be with their families, they know how to live their married life, etc. Then I think that also is a source of great consolation. There are the moments, though, where, you know, you feel so bad when somebody comes in a difficult stage and you know maybe they're not going to make it. That is very difficult. particularly when they're young, maybe the mother of a family or a young, very young family, or a father, or, you know, just a young boy or a young girl, and you know there's not much that can be done. That's difficult, and it's difficult to kind of take humanly. But hopefully we do the best we can. I would like to see that, you know, this whole AIDS pandemic, that it will be much more under control, that there will be a definite sort of a movement towards a way forward and maybe a vaccine. I would love to see that happen because, you know, for a person who has the virus, it would be great if it was rendered completely inactive, so to say, through a vaccine. So that I would also hope that, you know, a lot of the social and economic problems that we have would be ruled out. I think, you know, there is a lot of prosperity beginning, so to say, in the country in terms of mining and things like that. So I'm sure that will have its repercussions. And I would like to see a lot more help for the country or the people in the country by way of social services and amenities like that. And I think it could happen, you know, with good management and good governance, I think it can happen.
While it is clear that Irish missionaries are doing their bit in Zambia, do they feel other organisations and individuals are doing a lot for the country?
Aid comes into the country here. I'm not quite sure what it is at the moment, maybe about $500 million a year or something of that order, which would be about 20 to 30% of the total spending within the country. How much has gone out of these countries? How much has gone out in terms of natural resources, unprocessed natural resources that go out and all the value is added to them outside? All the are taking it out of here and doing the rest of the work outside. How much has gone out in terms of human resources? I'm not speaking of Zambia here, but of many of our countries, but a report published in The Lancet, which is a very prestigious English medical journal, The Lancet, last year, referring to Ghana, I think it said that Ghana had exported £65 million worth of medical expertise to Britain, but got back £30 million worth in return. That kind of thing is going on all the time. I said to you that we began with 106 university graduates here. The university here is producing graduates, and from, I think it was 1973, it was producing medical graduates. Not very big numbers, 30 a year or something like that. Half the qualified medical practitioners that we've produced are now outside of the country. So we're supporting other countries. The medical services of Britain, the United States, Canada, they couldn't, and even Ireland, I would say, could not survive if they didn't have the medical personnel, nurses, pharmacists, doctors, technicians, that they have now got from the least developed countries. So aid, I see, is in some ways, without it being expressly so, an effort to compensate for some of that drain and give back to countries what has been taken out. But aid is much more formal than that, because these are informal ways of going out, and they do bring back some return, the loss of personnel, because they're the remittances, just as they're the remittances that helped the western part of Ireland, especially for so many years from the United States, to keep the people on their feet, and they are helping people. But has aid done any good, or has it done more harm than it has done good? No, it is definitely doing good, and countries couldn't have got onto their feet, I think, without the aid that has come in. But there have been mistakes in the aid, there's no doubt about that. But there have been very, very excellent points in it also. Irish aid is very well received here. I don't mean that it's just received with open hands, but it's received very well from the people, because there's a great deal of human relationship in the way in which the aid works. And Ireland doesn't spread itself over a very large area. In the beginning, it confined itself almost exclusively to one part of the country, the northern part of the country. That's when Ireland was hadn't still broken the economic sound barrier, as it were, and didn't have much to give. And so it concentrated in a certain area, and it concentrated in the area of developing water resources for people, wells, boreholes, and helping them to maintain them, and also teaching the people how to maintain these. And I think that made a very big impact on very poor rural people, that they were able to live better because of that. Women didn't have to go so far to draw water. There was a safe source of water. And these things are very, very important for people. Now Irish Aid is spreading much more over the country. It has done very groundbreaking work in supporting the development of maternity clinics. In early on here, back in the mid-early 70s, 1970s, every woman who wanted to have a child, they were all being encouraged to go to medical facilities. They all had to go to the one centre, the University Teaching Hospital here, which just couldn't cope with the number of women. But through Irish Aid and through the efforts of the Holy Rosary sisters particularly, but other sisters' congregations also, a number of maternity clinics were opened in various parts of the city, and it decentralised that whole issue. And so that has now become standard practice through the country. The same was done in the Copperbelt area. And it was Irish Aid helped to get that sort of a thing off the ground. I don't say it was able to continue the resources to it, but something started there and that made the people so happy and was of such real help to mothers, to expectant mothers, pregnant mothers, women. And it wasn't that they just went there for delivery, of course. They had their antenatal clinics there, and these are now more and more all over the country. So there have been very, very significant benefits have come out of Irish Aid.
I'm very proud to be Irish, very, very proud to be Irish. And I would have to say, you know, from our Irish government down, we have really received tremendous support. Our Irish embassy here, they really do look after us very well. And when we see people like Paddy and the girls from Mary Immaculate, it really makes us feel very good. And we try to share what we have with them as best we can, make them feel welcome, and we hope they feel very welcome when they come.
Irish Aid formally established an office here in 1978. So there was a 50-year gap, you might say, between the coming of missionary personnel and the arrival of the Irish government, that formal presence. There's great collaboration between them, cooperation and understanding between them. The missionary personnel, because their numbers have gone down, know that they couldn't continue as they did in the past. They weren't able to do it, and they couldn't expand their work. They get a certain amount of assistance from Irish Aid through the Irish Missionary Resources Services and through some support for NGO activities. But the Irish Aid officers themselves know that they are building on the foundations that were laid by the missionary personnel. So there's a lot of synergy between the two of them, and it has worked out very well. And I think there's a great deal of respect. And the Irish embassy here has always been so welcoming of missionary personnel, and a couple of times in the year it runs receptions where they make sure that they are present, as many of them as possible, and acknowledges their contribution. And I think also the contribution within the country is acknowledged in general. So all of them are fused together by the people of the country. They're not distinguished between the embassy and the missionary personnel. This is Ireland doing the work. I don't think myself, from what I can see and what I hear about things, I don't think the poor are getting poorer, but they're not getting richer either, whereas the rich are getting rich. So they're moving further and further away from them, and therefore their problems are no longer, their concerns are no longer with trying to lift up the poor and bring them up. And I think there has to be very definite and maybe hard policies to try and transfer the resources back into the poor. Transfer them through education, through health services, through water and sanitation, and through infrastructure, roads and routes and the developments in rural areas.
Okay. And yourself, you're still working. Do you see yourself finishing up with work at any stage? Or?
Oh yeah, I see myself finishing fairly in the fairly near future, with the help of God. I'll go into the ground and join my God sometime. But for the moment, as long as I can keep going, I will keep going, because I'm in this area of HIV and AIDS. I've been with it for the last 2 decades now, nearly. And I feel I can make some contribution to a bit better understanding of the disease and motivation of people to do something about the disease, and encouraging the people who are doing work, who are younger than I am and who are able to do work. I think that, that is very important. So I'd like to continue that as long as I'm able to do so. But when I came here initially, it was with a view to staying, yes, to staying permanently. I didn't know how long it was going to be, but it was with a view to staying permanently. I mentioned that I had a brother here. He died 2 years ago, and he's buried here in Zambia. And that's the way many of us as Jesuits, when we came here, that was how we envisaged that our lives would be, the rest of our lives would be here in Zambia. So I did envisage that it would be for quite a period of time.
And are you glad you
said it? Oh, I'm absolutely delighted. I am a Zambian citizen. I took out citizenship here in, as soon as I was able to do it, in 1968. So it's 40 years ago now. I'm longer a Zambian citizen than I was ever an Irish citizen. So I am. I'm very happy that I stayed here, and I'm very grateful to the people for all that they have taught me, and for the warmth of their welcome and their hospitality here.
I'm getting old and old and old. I still feel very active. But what I feel is I would be very happy to be in Zambia. I like Zambia, and I've always loved it, and I like the people. If I were at the stage where maybe I was a big burden to anybody, I don't know. I wouldn't want to be a burden to people at home either. The way I feel about it is I leave it in God's hands, and I think he'll work it out. But I'm very happy to be here.
FM would like to thank all involved in the making of this series. Limerick to Lusaka was produced by Kieran Ryan for Word FM and was funded by the Broadcasting Commission of Ireland's Sound and Vision Funding Scheme.